haben.
Nothing is more expensive than bad information. Know the source. OneRadioNetwork.com.
Okay, here we are, hour number two of our little show. It is, you know what? Let me do this music for just a second. I gotta make sure I don't have some water on. I don't know if I turned it off. Hold on, save it, hold on. Ran downstairs. No, I had it turned off, but I don't remember turning it off. And I've melted one of those pots before. I was going to make some tea and decided not to. Well, anyway, it's time for Mr. Ray Pete. It's always fun to talk to this gentleman. It is the third Tuesday on One Radio Network, where he so graciously agreed to come and visit and take some of your questions and just kick around so much of his research, and we dig into all kinds of things. He started long ago with a PhD from the University of Oregon. He specialized in physiology. He started working on hormones in 68, wow, 50 years ago, and wrote his dissertation in 72, in which he outlined his ideas on progesterone and hormones closely related to it. The main thesis is that energy and structure are interdependent at every level. If you'd like to ask Dr. Pete a question, it is Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. Ray Pete, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you? How are things up there?
Oh, very good. It was sunny yesterday. Yeah? Could be again today.
Uh-huh. Are you getting some painting done? Are you becoming like your own little Picasso guy?
Not lately. Haven't done much for several days.
Uh-huh. Do you do, Dr. Pete, do ongoing research all the time? You always looking around?
Yep, always reading and trying to figure things out.
Have you figured anything out recently where you had an aha moment?
Yeah, really? A couple of things about how serotonin works. For example, people have known for several decades, starting in the 1930s, actually, people were realizing that hospital oxygen isn't good for people. And a physiologist, based on how people react to altitude, a physiologist tried adding from 5 to 7% carbon dioxide to the oxygen, mm-hmm. and they started using it in fire departments for resuscitating people, and it worked very well. So they tried it on newborn babies and found that it was good for babies to stimulate breathing. And it was used all around the country in fire departments for maybe 5 or 10 years, and then gradually went out of use, but hospitals almost always keep oxygen, plain 100% oxygen on hand for patients. But several people in the last 20 or 30 years have started looking at the outcome when they oxygenize a person. Mm-hmm. And when the blood saturation is approaching 100% saturation, when it's above 90%, actually, the mortality starts increasing rather than decreasing. And the hyper-oxygenated patients, actually about twice as many of them, don't come out of the hospital.
Wow.
And what I realized was that that's been known as an effect of strenuous exercising where you breathe very intensely, your blood can become very over-oxygenated. And they know that that increases prolactin as a sort of a stress reaction hormone. And so they tried just having a person breathe 60% oxygen or 100% oxygen, and found that that drives their prolactin very high. And I realized that what's happening is the lack of carbon dioxide in the blood when you're being treated with oxygen or just hyperventilating, and that raises the pH of your blood, causes the platelets to release their serotonin, and serotonin drives up prolactin. People have rejected that idea because they believed that there was a barrier, blood-brain barrier, that would keep the platelet serotonin out of the brain. But in fact, I had just been going over the evidence that in fact there is no blood-brain barrier. When you have too much estrogen, for example, the enzymes in the capillaries of the brain lose their ability to detoxify serotonin, and so it goes right from your blood into your brain.
So let's unpack this a little bit. So if folks over-exercise, we get too oxygenated, and we lose too much carbon dioxide, is that right, by breathing fast, if we breathe fast? And that's not a good thing, and that could that have been a problem for some of these people that would run 25 or 50 miles or something and fall over with heart attackers?
Yeah, exactly. And there are more than 300,000 people every year just in the United States who die with cardiac arrest. And it's known that serotonin increases the delay between contraction and readiness for a new contraction. SSRI, serotonin reuptake inhibitor antidepressants, increase that delay by raising your serotonin. So they are actually known to be able to increase the cardiac arrest frequency.
So that's what the SSRIs, Dr. Peter, are falsely doing, helping people to, quote, feel better by juicing up their serotonin levels.
That's the theory.
That's a theory. Yeah. Not good. So let's go back on the prolactin and the pH. So is this prolactin substance something we don't, you said it increases the prolactin when we over-oxygenate or over-exercise?
And starting in about 1965, when the birth control pills came on the market, there was suddenly an increase, I think it was about a 100-fold increase in the incidence of pituitary tumors that secrete prolactin. And that was an effect of the birth control pill creating prolactinoma tumors. And that, I think, is because estrogen causes you to hyperventilate, interferes with your thyroid gland, which makes you produce carbon dioxide, which is an anti-serotonin agent. And so if you're high in estrogen or low in thyroid function, you're going to have effectively a shortage of carbon dioxide and an excess of prolactin and serotonin.
So when we do exercise, we want to work towards not breathing so much and retaining the carbon dioxide, getting stronger, getting the heart muscles stronger and the blood vessels and the muscles, so we don't overbreathe. Is that right?
Exactly. That can make the exercise much more effective.
Much more effective. Why? What's the carbon dioxide, Dr. P? What's it doing in the body when you're retaining it? It's a good thing.
Yeah. It for one thing, delivers the right amount of oxygen to the tissue. The tissue, your muscle, produces carbon dioxide, and the blood arriving in the capillaries release oxygen in proportion to how much carbon dioxide you're producing.
Wow. So that's how we get the oxygen to where we want it, by having enough carbon dioxide in there.
Yeah, and the carbon dioxide, meanwhile, is keeping the pH of the blood in the proper range, where the serotonin can be stuck into the platelets. Hmm. The platelets lose their affinity for serotonin if you don't have enough carbon dioxide.
So the fewer breaths we take every day as we're working or walking or on the computer, the more carbon dioxide we're retaining?
Not really, only metaphorically, because if your thyroid function is low, you just don't need much oxygen in your tissues, and then you can be hyperventilating even when you're only taking 10 or 15 breaths per minute, because your tissue needs so little oxygen. If you breathe at a normal rate, you're hyperventilating. And the typical diabetic or hypothyroid person is going around just at rest with an excess of lactic acid in the blood, because they're losing carbon dioxide and producing lactic acid because they can't use the oxygen that is in the blood.
Because the thyroid function is low?
Yeah.
Wow. Man, you're such a thyroid geek. It's incredible, all the little moving parts with this thyroid. Man, very interesting. So, we had a fellow on the show the other day that suggested you could get one of these little laser temperature things. You ever see these, Doc, where you have a little gun and you just put the laser and you can put on water or, I guess, an engine or your skin and tell. And he said if you put it on the bottom of your big toe, it should be around 90 degrees for proper thyroid function. You think that could be valid, to that idea?
I've used the little infrared things that measure oxygenation of the tissue, and everyone, hospitals even, say you shouldn't get below 90% saturation, and if you go down to 80%, they put you on super oxygen treatment. And lots of people like to keep their saturation around 98%. But using it in different conditions, I saw that in cold weather, I could be exercising or whatever, but in cold weather, my fingers always showed 98 or 99% saturation. But when I was warm and my fingers were actually using oxygen, I could get my fingers down to 90% or 89% saturation. So if your tissue isn't using oxygen, you can be dead and still have saturated hemoglobin.
So what's the message there? I kind of...
If you quick froze a person's hand, it would stay saturated with oxygen. Those little gadgets that are sold so commonly and used in hospitals just don't say very much about your physiology.
Oh, you're talking about the little finger things that they put on people. Right, right.
Yeah.
And they can show... I put mine on, it's generally like 96, 7, 8. And I thought that's the good spot where you want to be, right? When you put those on? Or not? Does
that
matter?
In general, that would be good, but on your finger, since temperature regulates the metabolic rate, you can't really tell.
You're not really telling much. But They put everybody on these things in the hospital, right? Everybody, that's the first thing they do is stick one of these things on you.
When they were first designed for hospital use, they were actually very sensitive and measured the up and down concentration of oxygen with each heartbeat. But now they're just using these cheap things that show an average oxygenation, and it all depends on temperature.
But what about the laser where they're taking the temperature of the toe, and the toe is 90 degrees, theoretically?
Sure.
What do you think? Do you think there's some validity to that?
Sure, if it's temperature.
It's temperature.
If your feet are below, I think it's down around 80 degrees,
right,
they start producing inflammatory signals. And it can cause your whole system to become stressed and responding to inflammation. So warm feet, for example, will make you sleep better.
Yes.
By reducing inflammation.
Oh, so that's the whole classic cold hands, cold feet with the low thyroid people. That's what's going on.
Yeah.
Right. Can you walk us through what's happening when the thyroid is not producing the way it should, and how that translates into cold feet? I'm kind of curious about that, how that works.
The oxygen is making you burn fat and sugar, turning it into energy to use, and in the process of producing ATP and using the ATP, you're producing heat in proportion to the amount of oxygen you're using. And the thyroid is what makes you use oxygen to burn, preferably sugar, but also fat or protein. And so in proportion to the health of your thyroid, you'll be consuming oxygen and producing heat. So you can measure the heat a person is producing, but that would increase under the influence of stress and cortisol, which could be breaking down your tissue, not using oxygen. So temperature alone isn't enough. You have to know the actual amount of oxygen being consumed. That's almost all under the influence of thyroid function. And so in the 1930s and 40s, lots of doctors had their little apparatus, a can inverted in water with a hose to put over your nose, and then you would breathe for 2 minutes and measure the amount of oxygen consumed. And using that test, 30% of Americans were hypothyroid. But when the drug companies came on the market with a supposed way to measure the amount of thyroid in your blood, they convinced the whole world that only 5% of the population is hypothyroid. So immediately in the mid-1940s, people went from being 30% hypothyroid to only 5% hypothyroid. So it was a great medical disaster.
But you would think that their motive would have been to have more people being hypo, so they could sell them more stuff, right?
Except they made a simple physiological mistake, and
it's kind of wrong.
They thought that a blood test probably was more profitable to sell a phony blood test than their chemical.
Yeah. So I guess if I hear you right, then taking the temperature of the toe with one of these laser temperature things would not be a good marker to use for the amount of thyroid you need?
No.
Could it be closer?
It's one of the
just
signs.
Just one thing, yeah.
Like when you shake hands with someone, if they have ice-cold hands in the summer, they're almost always hypothyroid unless they're just very nervous.
Right. Yeah. Very interesting. Ray Pete is with us, Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. Stay right there, Dr. Pete. We got a little sale going on here. If you have a question for Dr. Ray Pete, we'll get them all in. Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. Sale going on in elk velvet. Have you ever wondered why elk velvet antler could be good for you?
So every year they shed it, and then in the spring they begin growing a new rack, a new set of antlers. 3 months. They grow it in three months. Think about the biggest moose rack you've ever seen, the biggest elk rack or deer rack you've ever seen. That's 3 months of growth.
It's amazing.
Now, so what you have is this organ that starts off as nothing and grows within 3 months to be an organ that's covered in skin, hair, veins, arteries, nerves. It's totally innervated. It's got bone and osseous tissue and bone marrow. It's essentially a limb. It requires special molecules like growth factors to accelerate the growth of it. And so there's growth factors in there that grow all the types of tissue that are found on it. Bone, bone marrow, nerves, skin, blood. All of that is being grown by these growth factors, and you can put that into your own blood and help yourself regenerate tissue.
Well, that's why we use it around here. You can click and order Elk Velvet Antler from Daniel Vitalis or Thrival, an Easter Thrival link right here on OneRadioNetwork.com. And as I said, we have still going on 50% off, 50% off on the Power Duo. Let me see what this promo is about. Sorry. Oh, I see. Oh, I see. So you buy an Elk Velvet Antler Gold, which is a good one, and then you get 50% off on the pure potency of pine pollen. Wow, that's a good deal, man, because that's pretty pricey stuff. This is the real deal, stamina, balance, and strength. So buy one Elk Antler Gold, or get yourself 50% off on pure potency thing. Pretty cool. It's right there if you click on the front page of One Radio Network, and they'll hook you right up there and have some fun. And also on Daniel's site, here's a little primer on colostrum.
Colostrum is this amazing food, and of course we have it in a powdered form, so it comes kind of like a dried milk, although technically colostrum is not really a dairy product. It is the sort of first food for mammals. It's made where dairy products are made in the body, or it comes from that same place, but not really a milk, even though it comes from udders. And of course, all mammals produce colostrum, and they produce that colostrum to feed their young mammals. Really love the idea that if we're going to have cows and we're going to milk them, that colostrum becomes the most medicinal part of that whole system. So colostrum in human bodies does a lot of different things, but its primary stuff is it keeps the immune system in shape. So when we're using colostrum, it keeps our immune system kind of like going to the gym almost, like keeps it fit so that we can fight off infection. It's one of the things it does really helps us do really well. And that's a natural, normal thing for us, but we're living in a world that really breaks our immune system down, so we need immuno allies. Probably nothing in the world supports our ability to stay antiviral the way colostrum does.
That's a lovely product. We've been taking it for years. Not that that means anything to you, but we have and love it. You can click and order colostrum, and you can order the 1 or 2 kilo containers. Get on the auto ship for the best price. And Easter Thrival link right here, OneRadioNetwork.com. Yes, sirree.
Know the source.
The source.
OneRadioNetwork.com.
It's the third Tuesday of the month, and Dr. Ray Pete has been kind enough to visit with us on the third Tuesday. And he's a rock star around here. He gets probably more hits than anybody around. Just a lot of hits on the podcast. So keep your questions. Dr. Pete, I have an interesting little tale about milk that I wanted to ask you about and get your opinion. In Ayurvedic medicine, they suggest that if you get raw milk that you should boil it. You know what I mean? Boil it. And they say that it helps to, let's see, what is it? They helps to absorb the fat more easily and helps to, if you have any bacteria or stuff that's not good from the cow, it's going to kill that. So I've been getting some raw milk and doing that. And I got a new batch the other day. And in the first bottle, I pulled out a half gallon and I boiled it, you know, just like I was, and put a little cardamom and cinnamon. And I had what I would say probably one of the worst cases of food poisonings I've ever, I thought I was going to die. And so, but I made it through. I didn't die. And a couple hours later, and I was fine. And 2 or 3 hours, I worked through it. But it was pretty terrible. I threw that bottle out. And I talked to a friend of mine who knows a lot about the raw milk thing, and they told me that, well, some people conjecture that if you boil raw milk, that you could actually, if they have a lot of bacteria in there, you could actually make that more toxic, and you'd be better off just warming it. Does that, can you comment on that comment at all, or?
I wonder about the cardamom. Are you used to using that?
No, no.
I would wonder if that might not have been an allergic reaction to that.
Well, it could, though, but I've been using cardamom for a couple months, though. No.
Oh.
It wasn't that. But how could you boil milk and have a get poisoned by it?
I don't think it would make it worse. For years, used either raw milk or boiled milk. In Mexico, we often used boiled milk because we didn't know the cows. But when you have your own cow or know the cow, then raw milk is fine.
So if you're using raw milk from a source and you don't know exactly where, you know, everything about the farm because you're not there, you think it's a reasonable practice to boil it?
Or at least heat it. You can inactivate the germs satisfactorily just by holding it at 160 degrees.
Yeah, maybe 160 or 170.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder what the difference is between like 170 and boiling it like 212. Is there anything that goes on in that range that we care about?
It inactivates more proteins when you boil it. There are theories that it improves or damages the digestibility, but it probably hasn't been researched enough.
I see. So that's the Ayurvedic claim where it helps you digest it more if you boil it. That's where they're coming from, maybe.
In Mexico, lots of people feel that they just wouldn't be comfortable with raw milk.
Yeah. It was the strangest experience, you know, and that's all I had for dinner was the milk, so it wasn't anything else, but, you know, what do you do with a situation like that? I guess you just go onward through the fog because you don't really know what happened, do you? You just
I have a couple of times got fairly sick from using an organic raw milk, and I think it was because the cows were eating weeds that I was allergic to.
Oh, that's possible, huh? Possible.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Now, right now, you're still doing milk, but you just do the store-bought organic milk, huh?
Yeah.
So do you heat that at all, or just warm it up a little?
Often I'll warm it to have with coffee, but most of it I drink cool.
Well, here's an email from Nick, and right on the milk question, I know that Dr. Pete is a big fan of milk, including low-fat milk. Does Dr. Pete drink milk with added vitamins? And if so, does he have any concern with the vitamins and our emulsifiers used? Is there a specific brand or manufacturer that he trusts?
I don't really trust them, but I drink it because it's available. But I'm very concerned about the possible emulsifiers they use to get the vitamins in the solution. I have been using the commercial vitamin added milk for many years and apparently haven't had serious problems with it.
Yeah, lots of them add that vitamin D, right? Is that what they say? They add vitamin D?
And A.
And A, too.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to often use emulsifiers to make that happen?
I'm not sure. Dairies haven't been willing to give me the details of how they do it.
I see. Follow-up question was, does Dr. Pete drink homogenized milk or some type that is non-homogenized and perhaps low-temperature pasteurized?
I like the low-temperature pasteurized. Usually I drink the homogenized just because it's convenient not to have to shake it up.
Does homogenization make it more difficult in general for humans to take milk?
I don't think so.
You don't think
so? I've seen the research that says there is a difference, but I don't notice any difference.
So that's just a myth that's been going on for the last 50 years, I guess.
Yeah, because our digestion effectively homogenizes it. The bile acids are an emulsifier that break up the particles very thoroughly.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So I wanted to ask a little bit about sugar. We were taught over 20, 30, or 30 years that, you know, white sugar and white flour, you know, are just terrible. It's just, they'll just kill you. Just don't eat white sugar and white flour, and then you're going to be fine. But you don't seem to be that much of a against white sugars, per se, are you?
No, not at all. But the evidence was very clear that they were using a bleach to make flour white, and the bleach was nerve toxic, and they demonstrated dogs would have convulsions and other fits.
I remember that. Yeah, I remember that. Oh. That's where that whole white flour thing came from.
Yeah, but they changed to a less toxic way of bleaching the flour, so it isn't a problem now. And the white sugar, I don't know of any bleaching process other than using carbon activated charcoal to remove some of the color material, but that isn't actually bleaching it, it's filtering it out.
So say a good white sugar, like a beet sugar, organic, is it really doing something good for the body, or is it just adding a little sweet that's kind of fun, nice?
It's sugar, which is very, very highly purified. It's more pure than many of the reagent chemicals they use in research labs. It's washed to a crystalline purity, and so it's almost perfectly free of allergenic material, which brown sugar can cause a really intense inflammatory reactions for sensitive people, and molasses even worse. And molasses gets the essentially the dirt, smoke residue and such from burning the cane fields. But the white sugar is very safe, and since it has none of the problems of fat, it doesn't break down into inflammation promoting material like all fats do. If you are under stress and have eaten too many fats. So it's safe for diabetics, for example. 150 years ago in France and England, there were doctors who cured terminal diabetic patients, far advanced people wasting away, but by giving them as much sugar as they wanted, which was about 11 or 12 ounces of white sugar added to the regular meals of potatoes, beef, vegetables, and such.
And they were curing diabetes like that?
Two articles on my website describe their experiences.
I've seen that.
How it works is that it suppresses the breakdown of fat in your body, and it's the free fatty acids are constantly, when you're under stress, they are constantly killing the pancreatic beta cells that produce insulin. And so you have a stressful event produce free fatty acids. They kill off your insulin-producing cells. And so you're unable to oxidize the fat, and it keeps you under stress. And you can break the cycle, as those doctors showed, by letting them have as much sugar as they crave. That in itself provides energy. Their blood sugar might go up to 400 milligrams per cent, or so, four or five times higher than normal. But in doing that, it's providing the cells the energy they need to stop the stress reaction, and that stops breaking down the fat, which is killing the pancreatic cells. Glucose happens to stimulate the creation of stem cells, beta cells in the pancreas. So sugar causes the cells to be renewed. Free fatty acids kill them. And so if you can break the cycle, keep your free fatty acids down, the glucose is going to renew your pancreas.
I guess you're not often asked to speak at the American Diabetic Association dinners? No. Wow, I mean, that is so contrary, Dr. Pete, with what's going on in the world of diabetes.
About 50 years ago in Israel, some physiologists realized that it's free fatty acids that cause diabetes, not sugar.
Free fatty acids.
And you produce free fatty acids when you're under stress. Diabetics can't get the glucose into their cells, and so they are having the equivalent of hypoglycemia, except it's neuroglucopenia. Their brain can't get glucose, and so it sends out signals to increase the food supply, and that leads to the breakdown of fat and production of toxins.
My goodness. So that is why some people could put on fat by taking too much sugar. That process, right?
If you eat more than you need, then you will put on fat for sure.
I found some the organic beet sugar after you kind of recommended possibly that might be a good choice. Put in my milk, and I really like it. I mean, it's just, it kind of tastes great, and I'm not dying or anything eating sugar, so I think I'm okay.
Yeah, and the beet sugars are mostly, some of them are grown in California, but a lot of it is grown in Idaho and up into the Dakotas. And in the mountain areas, especially inland, the rainfall is depleted in deuterium. Deuterium research in the last, ever since 1950 actually, but in the last 5 years there's been new research showing that heavy water, deuterium, is age promoting.
Yes.
And when the rainfall has rained out some of the heavy water, the inland, the last rain to fall, is lighter water. So beet sugar has less deuterium than tropical cane sugar.
That's pretty cool. Man, I like that. Because a lot of the beets are up there in that part of the world. Is that where the big beet producers are?
A lot of them in Idaho and up in the more inland areas.
I wonder, do we know how to get deuterium out of the water that we're currently drinking?
It's been done for the nuclear bomb industry, for example. But people have been trying to figure out ways to do it on a more practical scale. But for many years, I've figured that taking as much water as possible in the form of milk and orange juice, the cow and the orange tree are acting as filters. As they age, they accumulate deuterium, and the water that passes through them is somewhat deuterium depleted.
Oh, so the cows and the oranges could be our deuterium filter.
That's how I've been doing.
That's
it.
That's how you've been doing it. Yeah, that's very interesting. I don't quite understand how nature. You know, I always like to kind of go back to God or nature, Dr. Pete. Would come up with water that would have something in there that wouldn't be good for us. I mean, I don't understand that. You know what I'm saying? Deuterium might. Yeah. Well, we need water to live. Why would there be water with more that's heavier than what we need?
I'm not sure.
Yeah. One of those.
Nature does tend to filter it out.
Oh, it does.
The rain process, you evaporate selectively the water with less deuterium, and then you rain it out selectively so that the last rainfall. The interior of Antarctica has the least deuterium in the rain, in the snowfall.
The interior. Interior.
Up in the upper interior states of the U.S., around the Dakotas, for example, they're the most depleted.
Very interesting. Here's an email for you. From the 30s through to the peak of maybe in the 70s, many bodybuilders have taken large amounts of desiccated liver tablets to reportedly boost their ability to exercise and build muscle. Does Mr. Pete think there's a possibility of the large amounts of HEME iron found in liver becoming a problem of iron toxicity for athletes using high doses of these supplements? Or is that form of iron less likely to cause inflammatory issues and relatively safe to use?
Yeah, the heme group is how we use it in the blood, and it's the iron atom is isolated by the carbon framework. And so when you when you eat meat, liver, for example, the iron is isolated until it gets right into your bloodstream and cells. But if you take an iron supplement, the free iron ions react in your stomach, for example. People have analyzed multiple vitamin mineral capsules or tablets and found that they were adding iron in a tablet or capsule along with vitamin A and B12 and so on. And the vitamins were destroyed right in the tablet before it was taken. But if that same thing happens in your stomach, if you take an ionized iron form, it will destroy the nutrients in your stomach or intestine before they're even ingested, digested.
Speaking of bodybuilders, have you ever seen, Dr. Pete, anything over the years that people that want to just build muscles and are working at it, you know, kind of focused on it for whatever reason, to take supplementally that would help them and not cause them any harm?
Anything? Yeah, well, doing the exercise in the proper way so you don't lower your androgens will make the exercise more efficient at restoring tissue. But the anti-stress program, everything that keeps your cortisol low, leaves the androgens, such as testosterone and DHEA, active. Keeping the cortisol low is something that the Germans discovered in the 1960s, and they were accused of doping because their androgen level seemed impossibly high for an athlete. But it turns out that if you just don't exercise so hard, your androgens are much higher.
So they figured out a way how to kind of strengthen the muscle, put pressure on it, resistance on it, but not too much so the cortisol level didn't get too high, which turned it around the other way.
Yeah, the muscle, when it's properly stimulated, is actually producing testosterone or androgens. But if it's stressed, the muscle turns around and produces cortisol.
Wow. How do we learn how to do the muscle the right way? Is there a way to do that?
The concentric contraction is one thing that protects the muscle. If you lift a weight and then drop it without letting it down gradually. It's the lengthening of the muscle under stress that damages the muscle. And so if you walk or run uphill, that is the dominant action is concentric. But if you walk downhill, that injures the muscle because you're stretching the muscle under pressure.
So concentric contraction actually strengthens the muscle, makes it bigger. And that would be when you pull the weight up. Say you have a 25-pound weight down at the bottom, and you're pulling it up, and you're doing a curl. Then would that be concentric?
Yeah.
And then, and then if you just drop it down slow, you're saying that just makes it.
That's stretching the muscle while it resists, and that's doing microscopic damage, and that
cortisol.
It damages the mitochondria, so it produces less energy, and they've shown that in old people doing concentric contractions only, they can create new mitochondria and restore the energy system.
That's pretty cool. Is there any way to do that without just dropping the weight? I guess I don't know. How else would you do it?
They make machines that will do it, or you can ride a bicycle uphill and coast downhill.
Oh, wow. That's cool. But if you were doing like a chin-up, I like to do pull-ups, right? So if I pull up, that's my concentric. So how would I get out of there without going the other way?
The gravity is stretching the resisting muscle.
Yeah. I have to think about that. Maybe I could just drop, right? Just drop.
But that you don't want to.
Yeah, but I wouldn't do that.
The stress on your legs of dropping is probably
not good. I'll think about that one. Here's one for you. This is a good one. Along with diet and lifestyle that actively reduces serotonin levels, are there any foods and supplements that people experiencing a sharp deficiency of dopamine can use to safely restore the body's healthy levels?
To restore dopamine?
That's right. Let's see. Supplements. Yeah. Reducing.
I think the important thing is to limit your tryptophan intake as far as you can without becoming protein deficient. That's why I advocate gelatin, because gelatin contains no tryptophan, which is the source for serotonin.
Ah, so that gelatin has the protein without the tryptophan.
And it has the precursor for dopamine.
I thought we needed tryptophan to go to sleep.
Not really. It can, like histamine, too much serotonin keeps you awake.
What's the missing hormones that folks who have insomnia, sleep problems, which is epidemic in our culture, what are those hormones that are missing? And can those just be taken supplementally to help?
Thyroid actually is the main thing.
Thyroid, wow.
Many years ago, sleep researchers found that some people never got below the second level of the four stages of sleep, and thyroid deficient people went through the night without ever reaching the deep sleep stage. Stages.
Uh-huh.
I found myself that on a trip when I would have trouble going to sleep from driving all day, that if I took 5 or 10 micrograms of T3 thyroid, I would go to sleep perfectly in about 5 minutes.
Oh, just a little hit of that T3, 5 to 10 grams?
Micrograms.
Micrograms, wow.
Yeah.
A microgram is what, a thousandth of a gram? Wow, that's...
millionth of a gram.
Wow. How much would 5 to 10? I mean, that would be like just a very small amount, wouldn't it?
They make little tablets that are 5 or 10 micrograms
of T3.
Yeah, I've seen it work several times in other people. I always feel free to give thyroid to doctors because they are supposed to know how to handle it. But doctors with pains that they couldn't control or insomnia have remarked that they've never seen such quick relief, better than morphine, one doctor said.
When he supplemented with the T3.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Here's a question for Dr. Ray Pete. What does increasing thyroid have on testosterone and vice versa? The effect of increasing testosterone on thyroid levels, also the relative amount of increase someone might expect to see, and any difference in men and women. So let's see. Increasing thyroids have on testosterone and vice versa.
Too much thyroid can create stress and make your testosterone become wasted or not produced.
Mm-hmm.
Not enough thyroid will cause the testosterone to be converted into estrogen. Estrogen blocks the secretion of thyroid from the gland, and testosterone overlaps with progesterone. Progesterone has a powerfully releasing function on the thyroid gland, so that when it has been blocked by estrogen, a dose of progesterone can reactivate the gland. Testosterone has some of that supporting function for the thyroid, but not as effective as progesterone.
Well done. What does Dr. Pete recommend for corns and calluses? Know anything about corns and calluses?
Oh, I'm putting something on to soften the mm-hmm. callus, I think, is the main thing. Protect the cause. Bad shoes cause the callus to form. So if you get the right kind of shoe and then put something on to soften the
mm-hmm.
material,
mm-hmm.
Salicylic acid and urea are things that have commonly been used.
Thanks for having Dr. Pete on once a month. Well, you're welcome. It's our pleasure. Thank Dr. Pete. How do we take the edge off of learned helplessness?
In one of my newsletters, I went over several of the things that they've tested in animals. Thyroid hormone is one. Progesterone is another. An improved diet shifts you away slightly from the serotonin side of things, because serotonin is at the heart of learned helplessness. Harm avoidance is how one psychologist described the serotonin dominant condition, but learned helplessness is the extreme of harm avoidance.
What is learned helplessness?
With animals, they would torture them and not let them escape whatever the awful situation was, such as being thrown into a tank of water and forced to swim or drown. If they had never had the experience before being put in a hopeless situation, animals would sometimes let themselves drown in just a few minutes. But if they had ever been in a situation like that they managed to escape after being threatened with a deadly condition, one escape experience would change their perspective, which would change their physiology.
Wow.
So that they would then be able to sometimes swim for a whole day, many hours, instead of just a few minutes. So that is one of the interesting aspects of physiology that is usually well, almost never considered in medicine, but it can make the difference between resisting for maybe 5 minutes or for 10 or 15 hours. A total difference in ability to survive just by changing your mental picture of how things work.
How things work. Wow. Man, oh man, oh man. Hi, Dr. Pete and Patrick. Can Dr. Pete comment on how hydrogen might work with the oxygen and possibly CO2? Does hydrogen affect the thyroid?
It seems to work. The body has dehydrogenase enzymes that are in the habit of receiving their electrons from fat or sugar metabolism, but some people believe that they can receive electrons directly from molecular hydrogen, and that seems to fit with the experience of using hydrogen gas as an anti-inflammatory agent during surgery, for example. It seems to reduce the inflammation and stress.
Yes, they're using it in some places for stroke victims. You know, after stroke, they feed them the hydrogen along with the oxygen and helps them to recover faster.
In my interpretation of what's happening, it's working the way sugar does. Sugar provides a very generous amount of electron energy. Hydrogen does that directly, bypassing some of the enzymes.
Very interesting. So that's, you know, on the CO2, she had mentioned that. So people don't do that anymore. You said the fire department did the CO2 for people years ago, but nobody does that anymore, CO2 with oxygen?
I have heard of two or three hospitals in the United States and several in Europe. Germany, about 30 years ago, someone said that her father had a stroke while traveling. He was 90 years old or so, and went into a hospital in Germany, and they put him on carbon dioxide therapy. He recovered and went back to finish his world tour. But it's still pretty widely used in Germany and Eastern Europe.
Dr. Ray Pete is with us. Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. He's here on the third Tuesday. Good for us. Here's a good one for you. Some sources advise that wearing a hat to keep the head warm slows the aging process. Could there be anything to this?
Putting on a soft wool cap for sleeping. The head is the most intensely metabolizing organ. The kidneys and the heart and the brain have a very high metabolic rate, and so your head loses a lot of energy. And the big animals, one of the reasons they live longer is that their geometry has less surface area for losing heat. A mouse has a very little mass to surface, and so they radiate lose by conduction to the air a tremendous fraction of their biological energy. So in effect, they're living beyond their means. They spend energy faster than they can use it, in fact. And putting a nice woolly hat on either in the daytime or at night is reducing the stress, basically making you keep more of your heat. At the average temperature, 70 degrees, say, a person is losing more than half of their body energy, according to some experiments, by radiation, not just by skin contact.
At the top of their head?
All of their body is losing it, but the head is the hottest, and so is the worst leak of energy.
Perhaps that's where some of the old You see some of the old time way back where people would wear these caps to sleep or something. Maybe that's what that was about.
I've been recommending a sleeping cap for.
Oh, see, you're all into this stuff. I had no idea. Sleeping cap. I didn't even know you could buy a sleeping cap.
They should be soft.
Soft
wool.
Yeah. I bought some nice soft wool, beautiful organic socks for to prepare for last winter because I don't have any heat in my home, Doc. And there's only one problem with that. If you wash them and dry them, they're big enough to put on your dog. You don't want to do that. I wasted like $30 for these socks, and I washed them and dried them, and they reduced about 20% of the original size. Oh my goodness!
If you rinse them in cold water,
that's the way to do it, right?
Yeah.
Do the wool light thing, or just the cold wool water, and just hang them up. Well, I'm going to do that if I buy another pair. But wool's kind of good for those kind of things. Why is that?
The shape of the fiber. Cotton is good, but they treat it. Some wool has been treated too that it isn't really as good as the crude natural wool.
Yeah. There's something about the organic wool in pillows that they advertise about, wicking the perspiration a little bit and doesn't absorb in there, something like that. Is there something to
supposedly,
that?
Yeah, the wool fiber has a catalytic function. I think it's not quite as good as activated charcoal, but it can have a bacteria suppressing effect. Wood fiber, a butcher block made out of natural wood, has a self sanitizing effect because the structure of the wood cellulose units is toxic to bacteria.
Interesting.
I think the wool microscopic structure has that same bacteria suppressing effect.
On the butcher block, did that still work if you put some kind of a surface on it like they like to do, or do you have to just leave it a la just wood?
It has to be a natural structured wood. Anything that seals the fine cellulose structure.
That'll stain up pretty well, though, won't it? Probably, huh? Probably stains. No.
Yeah. The traditional blocks I've seen looked clean after many years.
How be done? Huh. What does Doctor think of as a good way to improve libido in men and women after age 40? Is taking DHA, progesterone, pregnenolone a good approach?
If they're in the right quantity. I've known a couple aging men who took 25 milligram tablets of DHEA, and their estrogen became as high as a young cycling woman.
You don't want that.
And their livers enlarged. So you don't want to take more of the androgen than is optimal. Like a young man produces about 12 milligrams per day of DHEA and about 4 or 5 milligrams of testosterone. And so if a person takes more than that amount, it's going to raise their estrogen and have a counterproductive effect. Pregnenolone is the safest one to use. I experimented for a year taking about an average of 3,000 or 4,000 milligrams of pregnenolone per day. Had no side effects at all.
3,000 or 4,000 milligrams?
Where 30 milligrams is a full replacement dose. I was just for fun taking 100
just for
times
fun.
That.
And what did you experience? I mean, were there good benefits from taking that much pregnenolone?
Very high stress resistance. Felt very good. Exuberant.
Pregnenolone. Pretty safe. You did 3,000 to 4,000 milligrams a day for years?
For 1 year.
1 year.
I ate a kilogram. I had brought back a kilogram from Mexico, and I ate it during 1 year.
And it helps your body to deal with the stressful situations better?
Yeah, mm-hmm. That was my experiment. My skin was sort of rejuvenated looking during that year. I had got saggy skin around my eyes.
Yeah.
And that snapped back into shape.
With the pregnenolone.
Yeah.
Interesting. Is Dr. Pete familiar with centrophenoxine? Centrophenoxine, a way to remove lipofusion from the brain. There's a study with rats that Damis is working. If not, I don't know. Could his research for the next show or give his opinion? The claims it's working. Sorry, I misread that. The claims it's working.
I've seen the experiments described, but I studied the production and metabolism of lipofuscin as part of my thesis, and so I've been interested in it for a long time. And one group found that vitamin E was removing it from nerve cells, which is much safer than centrophenoxine. After they demonstrated that their vitamin E treatment was doing it, they did a control test. They had been administering vitamin E dissolved in ethanol, and their ethanol control removed the lipofuscin almost as well as the vitamin E in ethanol. So a very tiny amount of alcohol seems to do the job very, very safely, like vitamin E.
Excellent, excellent. This is a good one. George wants to know, many people are proponents of taking black cumin seed oil fairly regular for overgrowth of candida and other fungus and bacterial. Does Dr. Pete have any experience with black cumin seed oil?
No experience at all.
Nothing at all.
But I've had a lot of experience with flowers of sulfur and candida and other fungus.
Oh, yeah. You mentioned that before, flowers of sulfur. What is that exactly?
It's precipitated or anything that produces a microscopically fine powder. Ground crystalline sulfur does not work. It has to be the non-crystalline fumed or precipitated sulfur.
They call it flowers of sulfur.
Mm-hmm.
And what kind? And that's like an antibiotic, isn't it? Did you say?
The fungus has exoenzymes that it secretes as part of its nutritional program, and these enzymes convert the sulfane form in the flowers of sulfur into sulfuric acid or hydrogen sulfide first, and the hydrogen sulfide acts locally on the fungus to poison it. But the trace amount of hydrogen sulfide that it produces in your intestine, for example, has simply an antioxidant function. Hydrogen sulfide is one of our intrinsic substances, like nitric oxide. It's produced by our own enzymes, so we tolerate it, and it has an antioxidant function. But locally for the fungus cell, it's very poisonous. The fungus kills itself by the way it metabolizes sulfur.
Excellent. Dr. Ray P. Patrick Timpone, we're going to wrap it up, and I'll do a quick little break, and then we're going to get all the rest of the emails. So stay right there. OneRadioNetwork.com. Did you know the AquaCure Brown's Gas Machine reduces oxidative stress?
Hydrogen is the world's best antioxidant by a long shot.
Hmm.
First of all, it's 700 times smaller than something like CoQ10, 400 times smaller than vitamin C, things like that. So it can literally go, the hydrogen molecule can literally go through everything in your body and go right into the very DNA and repair it. First of all, you're repairing oxidative damage, but you're also reducing or eliminating free radicals. Now, we're only the bad free radicals, which is another reason why hydrogen is good, because you actually have free radicals in your body that you want to keep. Example, nitrous oxide.
The oxidative stress, is that the main thing that damages the DNA and causes the regeneration to stop, you know, youthing or getting older, immune organs. Is that at the base, George Weissman, of most of the issues?
It's one of the
just
bases,
one of them.
But this comes back to that regeneration thing that I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The cells won't regenerate. You won't have stem cells and that sort of thing if you haven't got enough hydrogen.
And if our body is not generating enough hydrogen, we get dehydrated. Dehydrated. Lack of hydrogen. The AquaCure machine, 10% off, promo code ONERADIO. Use the promo code ONERADIO, 10% off in our store, OneRadioNetwork.com. Wayne Blakely, you have a wide variety of different products that we promote. I think there's 14 different ones, if that's correct. Why so many? I mean, isn't a probiotic just a probiotic?
No, there is well known. There's 28 probiotics out there that all help the body,
mm-hmm.
that really help the body. They're supposed to be in a healthy human being, including the bacilluses, which are the lactic acid producers. They produce food nutrients. And then there's bifidobacterium that helps form the molecules correctly. So there's different aspects of what you need, like, for instance, alfalfa. Alfalfa is a great product. It's got high in vitamin K, high in vitamin A, and it's totally safe to consume alfalfa. The problem with alfalfa is it's hard to digest. So we take alfalfa, pre-digest it into amino acids, enzymes, amino acids, so our body can assimilate it much quicker. It's great for vascular system, bone production, things like that.
Oh, that's great. Alfalfa, that's just one of the many products you'll see in this store, the Living Streams products on OneRadioNetwork.com. Also, they have a moringa, and that comes in the, I think it's a half quart, maybe a quart. I think it's a quart. And moringa, it's, there's a lot of cool things going on with moringa. And again, Wayne was able to put it into a form with the probiotics where it's digestible and it's all broken down, and you can actually, I mean, they sell moringa powder, moringa tinctures, all kinds of stuff, but we think this is a really cool cool way to get moringa. And you could read about all the benefits, and it's a food, and like the alfalfa, I think you do pretty fun and play around with it. Sometimes I just take big swigs of it. I kind of like doing it. I don't know. I've never. It'd be fun to do an experiment and really doing a lot of moringa, you know, over a year or so, like Dr. Pete does sometimes, but I haven't done that yet. Anyway, there's some cool things there in our store, Living Streams. Two of the foods are the moringa and the alfalfa in our store, OneRadioNetwork.com.
We talk about your health, wealth, and well-being on OneRadioNetwork.com.
The third Tuesday of the month, Ray Pete has allotted some time for us, and we're very grateful, Dr. Pete, that you do this. Thank you so much. Oh, here's somebody who wants to know if you get mucus drinking all that milk.
mucus is our first defense barrier against alien substances. So our mouth, nose, respiratory tract, intestine, everything is coated with a protective layer of mucus. And if you get bad milk, or if you're allergic to something in the milk, you will produce a copious amount. When I eat lettuce, for example, I get a very congested cough, a tremendous amount of mucus.
Interesting.
And anything that irritates your digestive system, raw vegetables are one of the worst things for irritation. But if a person is allergic to something in the milk, it will produce more mucus than normal. But I think a lot of people just don't like the concept of consuming an animal secretion.
Yes, I understand. No, but doesn't mucus coat all the stomach and everything? Isn't that one of the protective things?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. For example, our stomach digestive acid would digest our stomach, except the mucus protects against it.
Yeah.
And mucus catches histamine, for example, and should protect against it.
Well, when I had my little milk thing, Doc, I had a big tablespoon of charcoal, Boy, that it felt like that really settled things down pretty quickly. It was miraculous. Boy, it's good to have that around, isn't it, activated charcoal?
It not only binds toxins, but it can chemically break them down.
Really? Well. Or especially if you're traveling, right? Have some of that charcoal. You never know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what you come up with. Here's one for you. Doesn't sugar rip arterial walls, which cholesterol then patches up?
No. Sugar, you say?
Sugar. That's what the email was saying. Sugar.
Yeah. No.
Doesn't do that. But so the whole metabolic syndrome of too many carbs producing sugar that inflames the arteries, then the cholesterol comes in. That's just not a valid meme paradigm.
Thousands of years ago, doctors noticed that people with what they called diabetes had sweet urine, and so they called it the sugar disease. And in the 19th century. The sugar disease, since sugar was on the market by 1800, mm-hmm. Doctors said, oh, you mustn't let the patient with sugar disease have any sugar at all. And so they would lock the sugar and carbohydrate away from them, which was the thing they most craved. And this doctor in Paris, just not to be cruel, he thought it was cruel to let a person die without a taste of what they most craved. And so he, just to be humane to his patients, let them have their sugar, since he knew they were going to die of their diabetes. But when they got all the sugar they wanted, they didn't die.
So
that was what they call now type 1 diabetes.
Type 1.
Yeah, the diabetes, as originally defined, was a wasting disease in which you couldn't build tissue because of the absence of insulin.
Hmm.
And so you turned your muscles to sugar, and the sugar was lost in the urine. And so it was a rapidly fatal disease, which they interrupted by giving them all the sugar they wanted.
Fascinating. So the fasting blood sugar with the blood prick, you know, that thing, and then the A1C on a blood test, you're suggesting that these numbers are, use your term, are they meaningless?
Somewhat meaningless. If you interpret them properly, you would then say what's happening to the sugar.
Okay.
Why is the person making this sugar? And you would then look for the fatty acids in the blood and the amount of lactic acid to see if they were wasting any sugar that they were using and how much oxygen they were using and carbon dioxide in the blood. All of the relevant things should be tested, as well as the insulin. Would be good to know how much insulin there is. People are often put on insulin treatment or other diabetic drug without measuring those things, so they don't actually know what they're suffering from.
So you're suggesting an A1C may be a viable thing to look at in the blood test, but you have to look at other things like the lactic and the fatty and really make a determination of what that is saying, rather than just saying high A1C is bad and cut back on sugar.
Because that actually is more an indicator of fatty acid, unsaturated fatty acid breakdown. The glycation of proteins is not really glycation in most cases. It's really a chemical reaction produced by the small fragments of polyunsaturated fats that are breaking down, producing things like acrolein, which reacts and attaches to proteins and is interpreted as glycation. Glycation from fat is what most of it is.
Here's a comment for you. I bought 50 pounds of white sugar a couple days ago. I get the benefits of the sugar and get my exercise by lifting the 10-pound bags as well.
Funny. Yeah. I buy 20-pound bags when people in the supermarket glare at me.
They say, what are you doing eating that sugar? You know you're going to kill yourself, fella. Yeah. That's hilarious. Now though, so what's the difference, like honey, maple syrup? What's the difference with these foods? Are these guys generally good guys?
They contain lots of nutrients, mm-hmm. but the trouble is that they're produced by high temperature dehydration to make them concentrated and syrupy from the thin sap.
The maple syrup, yeah.
Yeah, and the heating process, since the natural sap contains some amino acids and proteins, when you heat sugar in the presence of amino acids, you get brown toxic material. And it's the brown stuff which is allergenic and slightly toxic.
So if you're going to do honey, you want to make sure you're going to do honey that's never been, no heat whatsoever, just honey.
Well, pasteurization temperature is fine. Doesn't
cause you can actually pasteurize honey? Huh.
Yeah, but when it reaches close to the boiling temperature.
That's not good, I often get optic migraines, writes Robert. I think that is what they are called, where the vision gets like a wavy underwater or wavy mirror-like, the ones like in a circus. I've been trying to figure out what causes them. They often go away in about 3 to 10 minutes. Stress, mold, toxins, any ideas I can look for?
The intestine is usually a trigger, but it's when you're not getting circulation to a part of your optic part of your brain, right close to where your optic nerve enters your brain, you're having blood vessel spasms, and serotonin is involved. Aspirin and sugar are first aid for that, getting your serotonin under control. Thyroid is a long-range preventive. By keeping your carbon dioxide up, it keeps the serotonin under control.
There's a really cool little product where you can get coconut, organic coconut milk with organic sugar, and kind of a treat. And no wonder my body likes that stuff. I mean, that's pretty good food, right? A little sugar, a little coconuts. Holy cow.
Yeah. I've known quite a few people who have taken sugar to sick relatives who were in the hospital being deprived of anything tasty. And one person who was in very bad condition had a couple tablespoons of honey, got up and left the hospital. She felt so good.
That is so funny. You know, isn't that hilarious? We've commonly come across the idea that moms don't give sugar before bedtime and the kids will get all, you know what I'm saying? You heard that, right? Oh, no, don't.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can eat one of these, this coconut and sugar in the middle of the night and go right back to sleep. I mean, it's like I ate nectar from the gods or something.
The blood sugar goes down at night, creating stress.
Yeah.
All of the stress hormones rise during the night, and you can minimize that with, for example, a glass of milk with honey.
With sugar. Sugar. Yeah, you told me that. You mentioned that before. That's what I do at night, with to put a little sugar in there. Wow, man, it's so great to have, not it being the devil that we always thought it was. Question for Dr. Pete. According to longevity researcher Aubrey de Grey in his 2007 book, Ending Aging, Ketosis can be up to 40,000 times more chemically reactive on blood sugar than glucose due to methylglycol. Any comments? What's he saying here? Do you understand this?
No, I don't know what he said about ketones.
So enriching aging ketosis can be up to 40,000 times more chemically reactive on the blood sugar than glucose?
Well, ketones can substitute for glucose. The brain can use them, but ketosis often refers to the condition that the body produces itself. If you find ketones in fruits and vegetables, they are very good for the brain and nerves. But if you produce the so-called ketosis, it includes some things that are not at all ketones. They're called ketone bodies, but one of them is a reactive alcohol rather than a ketone. And so the ketones you produce yourself have side effects. If you get your ketones in your diet from food, they're fine.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email from Thomas. He's in Sweden. Good for Thomas. Hi, Patrick and Dr. Pete. I was wondering if Dr. Pete has any opinions about this product being sold called Carbon 60 and its claim to be an antioxidant extraordinaire.
They are tiny particles, buckyballs.
Yeah, buckyballs, I think they are, yeah.
Yeah, and those are, I think, risky because the inflammatory triggers, a tiny particle in a certain range can activate the inflammatory process. So the research is extremely interesting, but I wouldn't touch the stuff myself.
Oh, because they're nano. I mean, they're nanoparticles?
Yeah.
Ah, it's the nano thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Further, here's the second part. What does Dr. P think about the general theory about antioxidants being molecules that give an electron to a free radical without becoming destabilized themselves, thus preventing free radicals from taking electrons and causing damage? Do we need all these antioxidants to protect us against oxidative stress, or are they a little overhyped in these antioxidant supplements?
Anything that stresses us increases our antioxidant system. And I think the worst damage to the body is an absence of oxidative processes or reductive stress, where for 50 years they've been talking about oxidative stress. I think we have to avoid an excess of electrons and simply keep our oxidative system working to consume the electrons, not to try to block them with antioxidants, because the antioxidants in themselves can interfere with oxidative metabolism. Cancer cells are extremely well provided with antioxidant systems, and that makes them dangerous and harmful. Don't go overboard on mm-hmm. antioxidants.
Mm-hmm. So that's why you've never been a proponent of taking vitamin C, right?
Because our diet provides 3,000 milligrams a day if you don't eat grains. Just vegetables, meat, milk, eggs will provide thousands of milligrams of vitamin C daily in the form of dehydroascorbate, much of it, which is not in the reference books because they don't measure it.
And if we do eat grains, what does that do to the dehydrate ascorbate?
Grains are the only major food that don't contain vitamin C.
Oh, I see. But it doesn't hurt the good stuff that we brought in. Okay.
No.
Good. In regards to aspirin, here's an email for you. Dr. Pete had recommended it, and I once heard him speak about the form he prefers. Is it crystals or powder? He said the type he gets can be stored for a long time in the freezer. Also, can he share where he gets his from? How much would he recommend on a daily basis for an adult?
Of which vitamin?
Aspirin. Aspirin.
Oh, aspirin.
Mm-hmm. What form do you like?
I use just USP aspirin, but salicylic acid is all right if you mix it with baking soda.
Mm-hmm.
But any aspirin that is in a form that doesn't choke you, it shouldn't be in a fine powder. But I use crystalline aspirin USP, and I try to average about 300 milligrams a day.
And why do you take that?
Just because it protects against anything inflammatory, pretty much.
Hmm. Crystalline USP aspirin, 300 milligrams a day. So the aspirin that the docs are giving the guys for the heart and the blood thing, the baby aspirin, is there anything to that?
I think the amount is too small for most people. And if you take vitamin K, you don't have to worry about the bleeding thing from chronic aspirin use.
And vitamin K is in cheese, some cheeses?
Yeah, aged cheese is a good source.
Aged cheese, yeah. Especially the blue stuff. Doesn't that have vitamin K, the blue stuff?
Yep, yeah.
Yeah, the blue stinky stuff, right? Can Dr. Pete explain why the veins in the back of the hands are an indication of estrogen status?
Ooh. Well, stress, where you, for example, might have low blood sugar, anything that weakens smooth muscle contraction can do it, but estrogen is a very common cause of that weakening of the smooth muscles. Varicose veins are an extreme example where chronic estrogen weakens the muscle. Absence of progesterone will let the veins bulge.
Absence of, so the cure, so if the veins are bulging in the back of the hands, you would want to take, how would you balance that estrogen out?
Well, sometimes just a glass of milk, mm-hmm. or orange juice or some soup or something to get your salt and sugar up. That's often enough to do it. But if it's chronic, then correcting your whole diet and making sure your thyroid function is good.
The old thyroid again. There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Lipomas. What are Dr. Pete's thoughts on the cause and function? I have one and would like to remove it, but I would first like to know why my body made it, and will it just make another if I remove the one I have? There's also many dogs get these little lipomas. The vets say they just don't worry about them. They're just little. But what are your thoughts? Do you think they're the same for the dogs too?
Yeah, I don't really know. Hypothyroid people sometimes, if they have very high fats in their blood, that supposedly increases the risk of forming them. But I don't think there's any harm in removing them.
You don't think so? Yeah. Here's one for you. I have been in extreme estrogen dominance all my life and had many surgeries for stage 4 endometriosis. I've had a complete hysterectomy 5 years ago and been taking 2 grams of transcendental estradiol daily since the surgery, as well as vaginal estradiol. I stopped these. Let's see, what's the question here?
All of the women I've known who had endometriosis over the last 50 years have stopped having all of their symptoms when they corrected their thyroid problem.
Thyroid. Yeah. They go on to talk about the progesterone and do I need higher doses to combat the high estrogen. So they're wondering about how much progesterone. But you're saying you would just definitely go right to the thyroid and look at that.
And check your estrogen levels. The thyroid should bring the estrogen down under control.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Could Dr. Pete explain how someone could detox DDT or other pesticides out of the body?
Mm. Keeping your liver function good is the basic detox method. Eating a balanced diet, keeping your thyroid function up, will make your liver handle things optimally.
Dr. Pete's explanation of how concentric exercise helps build muscle and produce testosterone, but using the muscle in the downward lengthening stroke produces cortisol and damages mitochondria is interesting and suggests careful attention to our workout routine is important. He said one way you could biohack your chin-ups would be to simply do them while standing on your rebounder and avoid the chin downs by just dropping onto the rebound. Oh, so he's already thinking. It's interesting. Biohack it. You just biohack it, right? Well, Dr. Pete, what's on your schedule today? Anything really fun and interesting?
No, I haven't thought about what I would be doing.
Yeah, me neither. Yeah, we'll figure it out when the time comes. Well, thanks again for being here on the third Tuesday. So tell folks, on your website, you have it's every other month newsletter, right? And we always put the link there, and folks can get that if they want, right?
Yep.
RayPete.com. Drink your orange juice, drink your milk, have some fun. Thanks, Dr. Pete. We'll see you next month. Take care of yourself.
Okay, thanks.
It's been an honor. Thank you, sir. Thanks for being here. Bye. Dr. Ray Pete. See, orange juice and sugar and milk. Who'd have thunk it, right? All the fun stuff in life. I just love the whole sugar thing. I just think it's great. Oh, man. I remember there was a... What was the book that... was it Gloria Swanson wrote? About sugar. And I read that, and boy, I'd been a sugar monster ever since. What was the name of that book? Well, I never should have read it, I guess. Oh, well, live and learn. Hope you enjoyed the show as much as we did presenting it. We will see you tomorrow. We're going to have a good show. We're going to dig into more of my research on It Takes a Long Time to Get Young, the name of my book. And then the second hour, we're going to talk to Richard Mayberry. Richard Mayberry is a very interesting man. He's the one that coined the phrase, the two laws. And I'll challenge you to come up with something, maybe you can between now and tomorrow, of what a potential illegal action would be that wouldn't be covered by these two laws. And they are carefully chosen words. Do all you have agreed to do, and do not encroach on other persons or their property. Richard Mayberry suggests if you follow these two laws, do all you have agreed to do, and do not encroach on other persons or their property, that would cover everything, and you're good to go. What do you think about that? Can you think of something that would end up in the courts where those two laws wouldn't cover? Email tomorrow and we'll talk about it. But we're going to talk about a lot of things. He's into investing, geopolitics, gold, silver, central banking. He's a cool guy. The early warning report he's written for years. It is Richard Mayberry, author of many books for Blue Stocking Press. He's a big fan with the homeschooling people that they do Blue Stocking Press. He wrote Whatever Happened to Justice, World War II, the rest of the story, World War I, the rest of the story. Some great books for kids. Whatever Happened to Penny Candy about inflation. Blue Stocking Press, some great books for kids. If you want to give your kids some really cool things to read, check out Blue Stocking Press and Richard Mayberry's books. So he's going to be here tomorrow. So we have a fun day. I love you all very much. Thanks for your ongoing support. If there's anything at all that I can do to help support you to reach your goals, I'm just an email away. Patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com. Patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com. I love you all. Thank you. Oh, Doodle says bye. May the blessings be.
We are listener-supported, One Radio Network.